Feel so professional.
Gracias.
Welcome to Conversations with Friends, a space for slow, unplanned, and deeply human conversations. I'm Linda, a German in my early 30s, a traveler who has spent more than 5 years exploring the world. And I'm talking to my friend Marco, an Italian in his late 60s, an artist who chose a simple life on the beautiful island of La Gomera after living many different lives across the world. Two friends from different generations, different worlds, coming together to explore what it means to be alive, curious, and connected. We couldn't be more different, and that's exactly why we meet here, as friends across generations to share our thoughts, questions, and stories. Nothing is scripted. We don't know where the conversation will lead, only that it will be real, honest, and rooted in what moves us. This is Conversations with Friends.
I'm really happy to be talking to you.
Me too. I'm excited to start. I think this is gonna be so much fun. Right now that we're sitting here, I'm thinking it's just gonna be so much fun for our friendship too. To just have conversations like that, like focused conversations, taking time for a conversation.
Yes, but it's not as if we don't do it every time we see each other.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm excited because other people will get to hear it. Because I found our conversations exciting and inspiring.
Yeah, me too. I feel super relaxed about the whole thing because yesterday when we talked about the idea and I asked you how would you feel about if only 5 people would hear it?
Yeah.
You were so happy. You were like, oh, that would be great.
Yeah.
5 people would hear it.
Yeah.
And this takes so much pressure off me that I know from my normal life where I have the feeling everything I do has to be a great success and it has to be bigger and bigger and a lot of listeners and stuff. And just doing it to do it and to publish it, give it out, and then just see what happens.
Yeah.
So today when I thought about this project, I was also thinking, I think I will learn a lot from it for my way of thinking about working. Not that I see this as work, but it's so similar to my work that I can learn a lot from it.
Yeah. It's true of almost everything that we do, I think. That I don't know. There is a socially acceptable way that's learned of what success is. And that, I don't know, if you're baking bread, it has to look a certain way. And if you do a podcast, it has to be done in a certain way. And you have to have certain goals and metrics and objectives and all this sort of stuff. But it's not true of the bread, and it's not true of the podcast, and it's not true of sex, and it's not true of anything. It has to be a certain way.
But when did you come up with this realization? Because you've had a life before where you had to fulfill certain goals and stuff, and you did it.
True. It always felt both exciting, or let me start over. My relationship with work and with data, because we're talking about metrics and data, was always ambivalent. On one side, it was exciting, In other words, I surprised myself as being the type that went and checked how many. And in those days, I wasn't publishing content of my own. I was running a small company that was in the internet business. And I realized that I enjoyed seeing the progress, and the progress was numerical. It was data-driven. You know, I could tell by going into my dashboard exactly how fast we were growing, how many page views we received, or how many subscriptions and everything. Like, I had my dashboard, and a visit to my dashboard in the morning was one of my favorite things. So it was fun.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I always felt that the danger that data would take over as the primary motivation and guide product development, for instance, too much. I always felt the danger that was intrinsic in the data of losing yourself in it.
Mm-hmm.
And always prioritized my perceptions over the data that I would get back. Mm-hmm. In other words, like, I always thought my decision is better than what I will make by simply studying data, because I have integrity, I have a vision of what I want to do, and the data doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if the data says that if I did it in a certain way, I would get better results, I never accepted that as sufficient reason to not do it my way. Yeah. But I did try it. And then when I came here, I really started to question all the aspects of my life that were driven by goals, because I want to be in the flow.
Yeah.
And a goal is an external imposition on that flow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you came here to this island of La Gomera 13 years ago, right?
Yeah.
This was the time when you stopped paying so much attention to these external things and listening even more to yourself?
Yeah. Yes, definitely. And it took place on this island, this awakening. And so I fell in love with the island.
Mm-hmm. For this experience too.
Yeah, because having given up goals, I had more space to actually feel the environment in which I was.
Mm.
And more sensitivity to it.
Mm.
So instead of my days being filled up with data and objectives, I suddenly had the space, an empty space, in which data from other sources could make its way into my silly little brain.
Mm.
And so I began to understand that the island has a rhythm, a personality, a quality of generosity that is unbelievable, and that it feels like a mother to everything that lives on the island, including people.
Mm-hmm.
It has a maternal, nourishing, nurturing, natural love for all its creatures. When I felt this, I felt she was trustworthy and that she wouldn't let me down, that it was safe to relax.
And it has been safe to relax for the past 13 years, right?
Yeah.
I think that's so interesting. And this is one of the things that inspire me most about you, this way of living and how you trust, yeah, universe, this island, whatever to provide for you.
Mm-hmm.
And still at the same time, because I'm much younger, I'm like mm-hmm. 35 years younger
yeah.
than you are, I have the feeling I'm not in this phase of my life where I feel like going to a place, letting go of everything I've done, of everything I've known, because this is what you did.
Yeah.
You let your old life behind and you started completely new with basically nothing. You started from scratch, having all your knowledge yeah. and stuff like this, but nothing external. And I feel like this is not where I'm going, because maybe at some point, but not yet, because I feel like there's so much more life for me to explore, also from external stuff. So I'm trying to find my way of living like this, but in a world where I have to take care of money, where I have to still create a lot of things and yeah, still take part in the world as it is.
Hmm.
And so I feel like I'm not entirely free from looking into data and making it affect me. Like when I look from my other podcast that I'm recording, when I look into the episodes and how many listeners I have, I'm not free from thinking, oh, this episode about this topic was so successful, I'm gonna mm-hmm. make another episode on this topic. It yeah. has an influence on me. And the same is about if I look by the end of the month, I check my listeners.
Yeah.
And then maybe it was less than it was the month before. It affects my emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's so stupid, because before I checked data, I was just sitting there minding my own business. I had a good day, maybe.
And
I felt
great. And this stupid number comes up and your mood goes for
yes.
bullshit.
And I don't want this, but I find it really hard to find my way through both of these worlds, because I know your world and how you do it and that it works. And there is a part of me that trusts it. But then on the other hand, there's a part of me that is like, yeah, I trust it, but I don't want to live this simple life yet. There's more for me, and so I sort yeah. of still have to take place in the other world.
Yeah. Well, you'll be pleased to know that when I first came here, I had a project in mind, a digital project. I had written my memoir, or several chapters of my memoir, I think 20, something like that. And I'd had such a good experience writing my memoir that I thought, wouldn't it be cool if there was a digital platform that helped people by asking the right prompts and questions to write their memoirs. Not only is it self-revelatory, in other words, it teaches you something, but it's also really interesting for your family. Like, I wish I could ever read my grandfather's memoir. Mm. I really would. It would tell me a lot about my roots and, yeah. So I thought I'd start a digital platform. It was called Myth of Me. And I went all the way to Australia for 3 months to build it with some friends in Sydney. And when I came here, I was ready to launch and market. And I did that for about 6 months. And then I realized that the data was ruling my moods.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And although before, when I was in my previous jobs, I was still earning a salary, regardless what the data was saying. And the emotions were intensified by the data I was reading now, because it governed a whole lifestyle, a whole potential for a lifestyle that I could have on this island. So it had all that much more meaning and urgency. So the mood fluctuations that it would trigger were more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, shit, I didn't come all the way here to put myself through this. And I gave it up. And then I only painted because it was far more therapeutic. But I'm just saying that to say that, yeah, I know what it's like to, you know, the feeling that you have to live off of this work so that, you know, it has to be well managed and well stewarded and the data has to support it. Yeah. And I still think that, you know, if you want to work in this world, you have to accept that pressure. I just made a choice.
And never regretted this choice?
That I have regretted once or twice. Because I have seen since other platforms come out doing the same thing. The same idea I had that came out later.
Mm-hmm.
And more recently how one platform has come out that leverages AI to help people write better copy. And that's huge. Because one of the drawbacks is that majority of people can't write. Yeah. So the stories that they were coming up with were a bit dreary in spite of all the prompts and everything. Whereas AI can turn anything into... So, yeah, when I saw that, I thought, shit, if I still had my platform now, we could make it, let it rip. But, so in that sense, yes, I've had second thoughts, but not strong enough to say to myself, well, dig it out, let's start again. Yeah. It was a cool name, though. Myth of Me.
Yeah, that sounds beautiful.
Yeah.
But it's not that you haven't created since you arrived here. You've created a lot. Like, you've created a life. You've created art. You've created this art studio just recently that we're sitting in right now. And you've created so many things also on a, like, interpersonal level, like relationships with people from the village you moved in. And we're always creating, right? But what I can see in you is that we, if we disconnect our creation, because I think everyone's constantly creating. So if we disconnect our creations from the wish of making money from it, and we don't do it just for the purpose of making money, it's a totally different outcome.
For sure. I think that if I were to start a podcast now, I would no longer consider the data relevant to whether or not I do it. Have definitely nudged me further into a sense of trust for a life, for life. And I worry less and less about staying alive and survival, because I've actually proven that that I'm still alive, you know?
Yeah.
In spite of not trying or, you know, being concerned with the possibility of not being alive.
I mean, I know that most of our decisions basically go back to our fear of death. We make decisions from a point where we're sort of afraid to die, so we decide to make money because we're afraid if we don't have money we're gonna die. And you sort of proved it in the past 13 years that it's not gonna happen, and there will always be a way out, and that's That's great, and that's inspirational. And I think I don't have, obviously everyone has this fear of death, but I think my fear of death is not my major motivation to do the work I'm doing. And I think this is a great step already. But then I can see in myself that I still have a lot of wishes, things I want to do, places I want to see in my life, a certain way I want to live in. Yep. And this needs money.
Yeah.
So by making this decision, like you did, of living a life where you just create for the purpose of creation,
yeah,
and where you can be sure that life will always provide for you,
yeah,
it also means that, or maybe it doesn't, but in my head, it also means it's sort of limited to this simple life that you truly enjoy, yeah, and you don't want to do anything else.
Yeah.
But I have the feeling I still want to do,
yeah,
other things.
Yeah.
And this is what keeps me in this position of where I still have to use my creation for also money creation, for example.
I don't think it's a virtue. There's a virtue in poverty at all. In other words, I don't think that that's should be everybody's aim, not to, or to live a life like I live. It's mine. But it's only because I have a whole bunch of things that make up my keratin personality in such a way that I actually love it.
Mm.
I love sort of the thrill of adventure, the sense of not knowing, the slight fear that this time you're not going to make it. And at the same time, I love even more the ability of coming through those moments with assurance. And each time the cycle is lived through, my trust and increases, of course, like with every success. Yeah. So it becomes less, the fear becomes less. Having said that, it's sort of something that really nourishes me. But if suddenly somebody discovered my paintings, say, and decided that I was the reincarnation of Picasso, and decided to sort of make me an offer that I couldn't refuse, and make me an instant millionaire, I don't think I would change my lifestyle.
Yeah.
But I would have nothing against receiving the cash.
Yeah. Yeah.
And at the same time, we're a different age, and you have a whole bunch of experiences you naturally want to have that do require money. Like, I don't want to travel anymore. I did enough.
Yeah.
I'm overkill on travel. Yeah.
I mean, I think one thing is that you've already lived such an interesting life before you came to this island, and you've had it all. Like, you've had the money and you had this lifestyle and you had all the experiences, so that now for sure you can say, I don't want it in this phase of my life. I think that's one point. But also what I'm just thinking about is that there's not only this fear of death that keeps people like continuing to make money. There is another big fear in society, especially, like, I'm from Germany, maybe it's a German thing, but there is such a big fear of being poor when you're old. Like,
huh?
Yeah. This is why a lot of people, especially in Germany, we talk so much about retirement money and stuff like this. And people work their whole lives in a job that they might even not like because they're afraid that if they're old, they will not have enough money.
Absolutely.
In their retirement.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe they have to work until they die, or maybe what happens if you're physically not strong enough and stuff like this. How did you overcome this fear? Or did you maybe never had it?
Okay, it's No, I've never been too prone to have that kind of fear. Mm. But I encountered it so often. I remember, for instance, my oldest brother trying to make me understand that, you know, life is serious and it's and that I had to approach it with a responsibility, and part of that is to look ahead to a part of your life where you will not have the energy you have today, you may not have the health, just like you're describing, and to freaking well put money aside. I also remember what was his name? He was like an investment consultant. I can't remember, but in America, I used to go visit this guy who gave me advice on pension and how much money to save and how should we do things so that we reach these goals so that you feel good when the day you... And I did that for a while.
Did you believe in it? Did you think it was important? No? Not even at this point?
No. No, I didn't. And in fact, I was certain that by the time I came of pension age, governments would be so bankrupt that they wouldn't be able to pay it anyway. They would forfeit on those commitments. And I thought, yeah. But I appreciated the fact that this geezer was, you know, doing his job and giving me the advice that he would give to himself. You know, and they tend to be very conservative, very aware of all the fear. But it's not something that governed me. In fact, I gave up a lot of money when I came here because I wanted not to have a parachute.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you take a bungee jump and you have a parachute, that looks really silly. I thought it would take away from the experience I was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And to reiterate, it's not something I advocate for anyone else to try. It's just something I wanted to do for me. And that was the point. I'd come at a moment in my life where I was curious about, what do I want?
Mm.
You know, I've done the work stuff, but who am I? What is my potential as a human, as a person, not my potential as a manager or as a worker or in this context, society? No. What am I like? Am I intuitive? Am I rational? Am I emotional? What thrills me the most of all these experiences? What can I do that reflects that? And I took painting on as partly therapy and partly education of what resides in my unconscious.
Mm.
Yeah. I followed Jung's advice and used active imagination as a tool to find out what is happening to me right now, because I wasn't so conversant with myself in those days. I hadn't become friends with me.
Did you become friends with yourself through painting?
Definitely helped a lot. I'm sure that wasn't the only thing, but...
Mm.
Help for me, it was massive. I literally spent the first 7 years on this island just painting.
Mm.
Yeah, I must have painted 500 canvases. Yeah.
And would you now say you're friends with yourself?
I am. I would say that I am friends with myself. I would say that sometimes I still let me down, or that I find things in myself that I'm not proud of, or that, but they're a part of me, they're quirks in my makeup, and I don't make a big fuss of them anymore. But still, there are moments in which, like, my breath, I gasp at the horrible, this horrible thing that comes up inside me. I say, where the hell does it, where did I learn that? Yeah, it still happens. But it's part of being, of becoming friends, is handling it without too much, making too much of a big deal of it. Whereas before I was, I would excoriate myself, you know, beat myself up. I don't beat myself up anymore.
You just stopped?
What, beating myself
up?
I became more tolerant. I became less judgmental. I think it's normal to have flaws now. So that I have flaws is not an aberration of nature. It's a part of nature. And that noticing a flaw in oneself is not the end of the world. It's just an observation. And you can then choose what you're going to do with it. I think more often than not, it is wise to just love it. And then watch a change because of my love for my flaws.
Yeah.
Instead of thinking I know better how I should be. How do you know? How do I know?
I also realized that awareness without judgment changes a lot.
Huge.
That's already the first step. And then sometimes it goes so fast.
Yeah.
I have the feeling change for me happens really fast.
Yeah.
And one way for me to accept myself more and also my flaws was thinking about how easy it was for me to accept the flaws of the people I love. I was looking around myself, like my friends, for example. It's a bit different in romantic relationships, but at least in friendships, I see my friends' flaws. And it's maybe not the part of them that I like the most, but it's easy for me to accept them the way they are and be like, well, that's how she is, that's how he is, and who am I to change it?
Yeah.
And realizing that I have this empathy for others and the ability to accept them as they are and still see all the things I like about them and give it more attention helped me to also do this with myself. To be as kind to myself as I am to others.
Would you say that your ability to be kind and compassionate and magnanimous towards other people's flaws has increased as you have become more compassionate about your own flaws? Or vice versa, that you first became compassionate of other people's flaws and then, I have my own views about it, but I'd like to hear yours.
I think there was even a third part of it, realizing other people accepting my flaws and just accepting me the way I was. When I started talking openly about things like, oh, I did this or I had the thought and I judged myself for it. And then seeing other people being so loving with me and be like, well, don't be so hard on yourself. It's fine. That's not everything that you are. That's just a small part and you don't have to be perfect. I think this also opened something in me.
Yeah.
If they can see me like this, maybe I can see myself like this.
Yeah.
And then it all worked together. It's really hard to say how it worked together.
Mm.
But I realized that when I was still very hard on myself, I was also harder on others. It's not that I've always been like this, like always accepting. When I was in a state where I expected perfection from myself, I accepted perfection from others too.
Yes.
And this made any kind of relationship so hard. Not only the relationship I had with myself, also other relationships. And I carried such a huge amount of anger and frustration because I couldn't deal with these emotions. And I think thinking about it, probably it was realizing that, for example, I had a big problem with making mistakes. So when it happened that I made mistakes and I was beating myself up for it, and I realized other people were way more relaxed about it. They were like, hey, it's just a mistake. It happens.
Yeah.
So through their reaction, I could see it in a nicer way for myself. And through this, I could have more acceptance for others. I think this is the way it took.
Yeah.
For me.
Yeah.
How do you see it?
I see it the same way as you.
Yeah.
I do see that. I recognize what you said about the role that other people have and their acceptance of yourself. It triggers in oneself the possibility that this thing that looks so terrible to you from a different perspective is not that bad. Mm-hmm. It's not like the end of the world. That mm-hmm. that really helps when you get that feedback.
It's so interesting, and this is where it all comes together, all these topics we talked about just now. Basically, nothing is the end of the world.
No.
And there's so many things that we think would be the end of the world. And so many of our actions are coming from a place where we think, oh, if this happens, it's the end of the world. If I do that, it's the end of the world. If he does that, it's the end of the world. But then realizing basically nothing is the end of the world. Maybe it's a bit of an uncomfortable experience, but we can also overcome this. And we'll learn that we just overcame an uncomfortable experience, which will make us stronger and stuff like that. So this is such a power move to realize nothing is the end of the world.
Absolutely true. You know, I think that has always been a concept associated with leadership.
Hmm.
At least for me.
Mm-hmm.
A leader, amongst many qualities,
mm-hmm.
is also one who, when everyone panics, thinks it's the end of the world,
mm-hmm.
he doesn't lose his mind.
Yeah.
He knows that somehow his own self-control or his own self-awareness is part of what allows a solution to be found.
Mm.
That it is more important to your ultimate safety and to coming out of this, in parentheses, dangerous situation.
Mm-hmm.
That a key factor is your ability not to lose touch that it's not the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
The minute you know that in the midst of danger, you become an immediate attractor of solutions to the problems at hand.
Mm-hmm.
It's, yeah, and therefore we attribute it as a sign of leadership in the majority of cases.
Yeah.
But it's really that self-awareness and that self-control triggers the solution.
Yeah.
It emerges then. Whereas if there's a bunch of people running around like chickens with their heads cut off, the chances of finding a solution are slim.
Mm.
Yeah.
So you've been a leader many times in your life, right? You've been a leader to spiritual communities. You've been a leader to companies. You've been a leader to so many things. Also like a leader to a family at some point, like so many different things. But when did you become a leader? Like when did you learn all of these? It's only one thing to keep calm in situations like this. There are also other qualities to be a good leader. Like, how did you become a good leader? How did you become a leader?
First of all, I strongly believe that the only thing I can lead is myself. And that leading other people is nonsense. It's a trap of the ego. It's nonsense. By leading yourself, you automatically are a leader. It's not like you. It's not based on the number of followers or anything like that. Although I went through phases in which I did think so.
Yeah.
I kind of grew out of it.
Yeah.
And so I can tell you that I'm still not a leader today. If a leader is somebody who makes a difference wherever he or she is, then I have more to learn than I have learned. Way more. Because the potential for each person to be a powerful agent of change is so huge in comparison to what we actually manifest. We can be, you know, immensely transformative. And it's always ridiculous to try and assess how transformational one is, but being realistic, I would say that's 10% of the way there. I would guess. And when you say I've always been a leader, I think there's an element of fate that enters into it. You know, some of us have just fated that we don't really also on the other side of the scales. There's an ego issue associated with leadership. So as a kid, I wanted to be a leader. If there's a choice, I can be a leader or a follower. You know, I'll be John Wayne if you give me a choice. So even though I didn't know what I was doing, there was a sense of pride in being the one people listen to or something like that. And perhaps sometimes they didn't want to listen to me, but I imposed it on them.
Yeah. I think I've been the same. I think I've always wanted to be a leader. And I thought for a very long time that everyone's like this. That being the leader is the only position that everyone wants to have. And now I realize it's not like that. There's so many people who don't want to lead, not even themselves, because it's so much responsibility.
That's pretty sad.
If you say so, I don't know. I mean, for me, it also feels a bit like this from my perspective, because I enjoy this. I even enjoy self-leadership.
Yeah.
And where it can take me and all these experiences. And I couldn't imagine a different life. But then I think, like, who am I to tell other people how to live? And if they if they crave security and safety, and if they crave boundaries that other people set for them, and a path that other people tell them to follow, and they're absolutely happy about it, and it gives them everything they need. It's not sad. It's
who are we to argue?
Yes.
Yeah. I guess when I project myself in those shoes, it feels sad, but that's me.
Yeah. I think that if every person would just follow their true nature, there would be a perfect balance. There would be the exact amount of leaders we need, but there would also be the exact amount of followers we need. But then also thinking about everything, you know, thinking about all the things we would need to live in a healthy way on this planet.
Yeah.
There would be a solution for everything if people would start following their true nature, following their heart, following their path.
Yeah.
And not act from a place of fear or scarcity or...
Another thing I think it's worth raising is, I don't know if you'd agree with this, but I think that every good leader is a good follower. That there is no ego attachment to leadership, and therefore you're free to let the circumstance reveal instead of imposing oneself as a leader. You're fully prepared to be a follower if somebody else pipes up. In the absence of anybody doing this, though, I'll do it. But the less ego there is involved in leadership, obviously, the more trustworthy the leader is.
The easier it is
to follow.
I think it truly depends on that.
Yeah.
Because I can see so many leaders that are clearly ego-driven.
Yep.
And not live up to the best results.
Yep. Like I said to you, there was that Greek philosopher who said the only people who should be allowed to lead are the ones who don't want to.
Yeah. And I think also every person that really reflects on themselves not based on their ego would realize that they probably have some things they're really good in, but not everything, you know?
For sure.
There's even only a very small part in life that you master. And
totally
everyone
true.
Masters their own chapters.
Yeah.
And so we need each other's, and we need to be maybe a leader in the things that we mastered, but for sure we need to be a follower in the things that we didn't master.
Mm-hmm.
And that will always be the majority of topics, situations.
Yeah.
But it also needs the people to stand up for themselves so that we can see the people that mastered something.
I think that leadership is also a function of authenticity and genuineness.
Mm.
In other words, like the more authentic a person is, the more they're a natural leader in certain sections where they naturally excel.
Yeah. So a true leader doesn't have to fight for followers and followship, or however you say it. They would just be themselves in the most authentic way, and people would see it and they would follow because they truly believe in it. And the leader proves its leadership without trying to prove it.
And also, I think that in a perfect world, which is not what we have, in the sense that we're not at the apex of our potential by far.
Hmm.
We have ways to go. But in a perfect world, I imagine that everyone, every single person, is a leader.
Hmm.
Nobody listens to another person. In other words, there's no need for leaders and followers because by being ourselves authentically and therefore leaders, we place our piece of the puzzle into the picture that life is trying to determine.
That's such a beautiful picture.
And it's a bit like nature. Nobody tells nature what to do.
Yeah.
And yet it arranges itself in patterns that are able to survive.
Yeah.
And bear fruit without an external government. And I think human beings have the potential of doing the same thing.
I wish it was like that.
You've heard of, I'm sure you have, heard of a natural process that birds and fish get involved in. When there are big schools of fish or hundreds of thousands of starlings in the air, and they begin to have what's called a murmuration, where hundreds of thousands of birds appear to be perfectly coordinated and in motion, creating patterns that are unbelievably complex and sacred geometric patterns even that come up spontaneously out of this group that has no leader.
Yeah.
It appears as if every single bird is aware of the seven birds closest to him only. And that somehow he coordinates with those seven. But because those seven are coordinating, it goes on and on and on. There's an overall intelligence that governs them all, and spontaneously, anarchically coordinates. That's why anarchy is a really interesting concept. There is no leader, there is no external government, but everything somehow works.
But if it works that well, why don't we just live like that?
Because we don't believe it will work. We believe that, you know, if we didn't put criminals in jail, they would go out and murder somebody else. And so, you know, we need to keep the peace. We need to have systems of justice. We need to make sure that citizens behave in certain ways and not in others. We don't think that if you just let a child grow, the outcome will be the best possible result. We think we have to educate that child, hand over our wisdom. And in doing so, we also hand over our fears, our wrong assumptions, and we inculcate them into the next generation, who then grows up believing in these limits and therefore accepts external leadership and government. And yeah, that's what I think. I think that we need a full generation to live on this planet without or not without, with a passion for life as their primary motivator. One generation needs to live through their whole life cycle and therefore impact the other generations opposite them, following them, in order to make significant change happen. Yeah. And I think it's coming.
You think so?
Yeah, I do.
I think that sounds so beautiful, and I think we're on the same page about thinking this would be great.
Yeah.
But then I also think we're in this bubble, you know? Like, we're moving in this bubble of, like, maybe a beautiful island, but then on the other hand, a sort of spiritual community, like friends who have sort of the same thoughts.
Yeah.
And then the moment I enter a big city, which I rarely do, but the moment I enter a big city, I'm like, oh, I almost forgot that I'm just living in this tiny, tiny, tiny bubble.
Yeah.
And that it seems like all the change that I'm seeing in the world is only a change in my very tiny bubble.
Yeah. Fair enough. Good observation. Now, I too
Which doesn't
going
mean
to a city blows me away.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't mean that it's not important change that is happening.
Yeah.
And there is change happening, but sometimes it's just disappointing.
Well, let's say that my experience going to a city, the negative experiences I might have doing so, are not the city's fault. It's not even my fault, but it's a question of what I'm accustomed to, what you're accustomed to. So living in a village like this, I'm simply not accustomed to dealing with the frenetic, busy vibes of a city.
Mm.
I would need to become acclimated to that, and then I would handle it with more aplomb, or I wouldn't be so affected by it. So I think there's a function in that, in the experience you're describing, that is just we naturally acclimate to an environment, the environment we're in. If you live in a city, you're accustomed to that environment, and therefore have a difficult time coming to an island like this, being in a small village, and you're simply not used to it, and you go through a time of adjustment.
Yeah.
But many people would be capable of adjusting to this village, and just as many would be capable of going to a city and adjusting there. Question is whether you want to, but you can. Becomes more of an issue. Change becomes more of an issue as you get older, I think.
I'll find out.
Yeah, we'll find out.
So, Marco, how do you feel about our first episode, your first ever podcast episode?
I feel really, really grateful, especially for you.
Oh, thank you.
I'm serious. That, because it's your presence and your expertise that inspired me to even think of it.
Mm.
Your friendship is what, I mean, the fact that we have such interesting conversations is what inspired it. So I'm super grateful for you. And your zest for life and for a mixture of determination that you display and creativity. And love. Yeah. Love for your human, your human beings. So that's how I feel after my first podcast, is appreciation for you.
Thank you.
And also
so much.
For excited about what the heck this thing will sound like.
Yeah, that's exciting. Yeah. Me too. I'm really happy to start this chapter, however long it takes. I think it's just such an interesting perspective. I also find this not only in this podcast, also in our friendship of like two people that are so different, but still on the same page in so many things, and still we have our differences. But just the fact of a man and a woman sitting here talking, and then your age and my age, we are basically different generations, and then such a different way of living life, but still sharing a lot of values, and having, even if we come from such different directions, somehow meet in this moment, in this place, and in this situation. And this makes it so interesting for me, and I think It can also be very interesting for a lot of people. So I'm really curious to see how this will go and where it takes us with just pure joy by just doing it. No expectations, and that's new for me, and that's great.
Remind me what year you were born in.
1991.
Okay. I was just thinking that you must be about the same age as my daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And you are. My daughter was born in 1993.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's nice to have a friend of your age.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to feel like there's actually a deep understanding between us, even though you are a different generation, that we can communicate pretty well. It's good because it gives me an insight into how people your age think and how they look at life and the world is changing so fast, and even between my generation and yours, there's such a different perspective.
Yes,
that's why they call me a baby boomer. And you,
what are you? Millennial.
Millennial.
Yes.
But to find a common thread is. In the story between us, to feel this, as you say, where values are shared is wonderful.
Yeah. And so much potential to learn from each other and to grow together if we decide to listen to each other. And I think this is what we're doing here.
Yeah. Maybe that's a sign.
It's a sign to end this here. Thank you so much for sharing this conversation with me.
Super glad.
Can't wait for the next one. Thank you so much for being here, for listening, for sharing this space with us. May these conversations remind you to open yourself to people who are different from you and to discover what you can learn from them. We'd love to hear your thoughts and reflections. Feel free to share them with us. Check the show notes for more about us and join us again for the next conversation.